Today, Psalm 72, a psalm surprisingly central to the entire point of Scripture and the Good News.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
We continue forward in the Psalms today, 72nd Psalm, finally, which begins with the words of Solomon, this superscript. And it's really important this time. So this is the end of, I suppose it's book two of the Psalms, yeah. And book three begins next, out of all this division of the Psalms, this basic division of the Psalms. And, you know, I mean, obviously it's organized later and so on, compiled. So, you know, how essential it is that it's organized into these books is secondary. However, this psalm is appropriately placed at the end of a set of psalms that we can identify still with Davidic authorship. And so there's a lot of Davidic, there are a lot of Davidic psalms in here that we've been reading. Not as many as in the first book, but still a lot. And importantly, this psalm ends at the very end of verse 20, just like the superscript begins with, of Solomon, or to Solomon, or for Solomon, something like that. We don't know which exactly. I mean, it's all based on context. And as you'll see in a moment, it's certainly not Solomon's writing, unless it was written retrospectively. But it clearly is the message of David, and so I would assume it's David writing it for Solomon, that he provides the psalm for us for Solomon. Because when you get to the end of this psalm, and perhaps this is inserted, perhaps it's there to make the division in the psalms. But verse 20 is, the prayers of David, the son of Jesse, are ended. And so there's an invitation for us to consider that this psalm is written specifically for the point of drawing our attention to David handing the kingdom to his son Solomon. So David's prayer in this psalm appears to be his preparation for Solomon to become king. So putting that in context, you know, he's making the choice late in his life as he's preparing to die to hand things over to Solomon, most important of which is the responsibility for building the temple. I know you remember David wants to build the temple. God says, nah, you're too bloody, too guilty, too violent. I'm not going to allow you to do it, but your son Solomon can, and you can prepare for him. So it's like that. And so what I want to read to you is the background before we read David's prayer for his son. His prayer begins with, give the king your justice, O God, and your righteousness to the royal son. He's praying it over his son, Solomon. There are lots of parallels here. There are lots of ways that you could use this psalm to talk about how we pray for our children, pray for our disciples, pray for those we've taught or mentored, and so on. But this one is particular. It is about God's kingdom. It is about his people. And it is about the next king, the one who follows the chosen one of the Old Testament, David. Even when Jesus is born, he's going to be born as the son of David. So for David to be praying for his son is an important prayer for us to understand. And lo and behold, as I worked my way through this psalm, I discovered it is central to the message of all of Scripture, to the whole point of why we exist and so on. So in David's prayer, you'll have this great revelation of what God is doing, you know, with history. So in 1 Chronicles, that's the book, the historical book I'll use to make this point. In 1 Chronicles, it starts around chapter 22, where you have David talking to Solomon and praying to God for Solomon. And you have a repetition of a lot of the ideas that are in this psalm. So I sort of want to lay the groundwork by reading some of those to you. But most importantly, I want you to get this part, because I'm not going to read the bulk of those chapters, because the bulk of those chapters, all the way from chapter 22 to the end of 1 Chronicles 22, and I'll stop in chapter 28, the bulk of those chapters is about building the temple. I mean, that's the great monument of that section of Scripture and of the transition of power from David to Solomon. All of the things that come about in Solomon's life are built around or centered around his building of the temple in fulfillment of David's plans for there to be this great house of God in Jerusalem under his reign. So in 1 Chronicles 22, in the midst of all of these statements about having prepared all of the resources, both human and material, for Solomon to build the temple, here's what David says. "Now, my son, the Lord be with you." Now, again, this is just caked in references to the temple before and after all of these statements. But I want to read you these three because they're the only instructions that are not about building the temple itself. "Now, my son, the Lord be with you, so that you may succeed," here you hear the reference, "in building the house of the Lord your God as he has spoken concerning you. Only may the Lord grant you discretion and understanding, that when he gives you charge over Israel, you may keep the law of the Lord your God. Then you will prosper if you are careful to observe the statutes and the rules that the Lord commanded Moses for Israel. Be strong and courageous. Fear not. Do not be dismayed." Exactly like Moses giving the leadership to Joshua, exactly the same kind of charge that's being given now to Solomon from David, his father. And it's not specific at all. You know, it's this one thing. Just keep the law. Make sure you remember the commandments of God. It's so generic, you don't even know what it is. But when we get to the psalm and the actual prayer of David, we'll know exactly what it is. And it is not what we normally focus on. It's not what we pay attention to in our culture, but we ought to. And so as we're hearing this, we're getting a great reminder of how God sees his holiness being revealed in the earth, because that's what the temple is for, to show the presence of a holy God in the midst of his people. That's why the temple is there. And the only reminder David is giving Solomon outside of build this temple is the way people see the holiness of God in his people, which is in his righteousness. So make sure you do what God actually commanded you to do. So in 1 Chronicles 28, six chapters later, by the way, it's only five, six chapters later, because in the meantime, he's been appointing Levites and appointing all of these different people to accomplish the different parts of what's going to be required to run the kingdom while you're building a temple. The whole thing is just build a temple. And he says this in 1 Chronicles 28. He interrupts it to say this, "And all of my," this is David explaining to Solomon why he's going to be king and what he needs to do as he becomes king. And so he's recounting what happened. "And all of my sons," for the Lord has given me many sons. You know, I've been around people like that. So you know how well I've been blessed. Anyway, "and all of my sons," for the Lord has given me many sons, "of all of my sons, he has chosen Solomon, my son, to sit on the throne of the kingdom of the Lord over Israel. He said to me, 'It is Solomon, your son, who shall build my house and my courts, for I have chosen him to be my son, and I will be his father, and I will establish his kingdom forever if he continues strong in keeping my commandments and my rules as he is today. Now, therefore, in the sight of all Israel," David goes on, "the assembly of the Lord, and in the hearing of our God, observe and seek out all the commandments of the Lord your God, that you may possess this good land and leave it for an inheritance to your children after you forever." He goes on immediately after that to say this, "And you, Solomon, my son, know the God of your father and serve him with a whole heart and with a willing mind. For the Lord searches all hearts and understands every plan and thought. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will cast you off forever. Be careful now, for the Lord has chosen you to build a house for the sanctuary. Be strong and do it. Now, there's an immediate attachment between these commands for Solomon to keep the commandment of the Lord, follow the law of the Lord, know the law of the Lord, seek the Lord with all your heart. There's an immediate connection between all of those commands, obviously, and then the command to build the temple. I'll explain that relationship in just a moment, or we'll jump into it in just a moment. But with all that said, all of these commands are empty. None of them have the content built into them. Follow the law of the Lord. Okay, I'm learning to drive. Follow the rules of the road. What are the rules? Just follow them. You know, I don't know what they are. And nowhere in here is David telling Solomon what the law of the Lord is. He's only telling him to make sure he knows the law of the Lord. That doesn't mean Solomon doesn't know it, nor that he can't discover it, nor that he can't read it. It doesn't mean any of that. Obviously, there is specific content to the law. My point is, in all of these statements at the end of 1 Chronicles, you just get the same kind of stuff you get throughout Scripture, where we're told, well, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments. Jesus goes on to say what some of his commandments are and the ones that are most important to him. Here, David doesn't do that. He leaves it open-ended for us in the historical account in 1 Chronicles, but it's not open-ended in the psalm at all. And so it becomes really important when we're reading this psalm and we see David praying for Solomon because Solomon will obey in particular ways. We should be able to understand just how important those ways are, how central those ways are to being obedient to Yahweh, to fulfilling the righteousness of God in this world. So it's going to be really important to us as we're reading the psalm to recognize that he's not just picking random favorable attributes of Solomon, but he's identifying the things that tell us that Solomon is going to be obedient to God's most important commands in this world. And I wish it were just natural that we would automatically recognize what is so important to God and how we obey him in this world. But we don't. We have arbitrarily, it's not even arbitrary, we have chosen commands that we think are more important, I think partially because they're self-serving. They help us feel good about how well we're doing it. And it gives us a simple list of things that we can do to fulfill his righteousness in the world. And we're not doing it at all. We're sort of ignoring some of the most important commands, as you'll see as we start into the psalm in just a moment. Now, into the psalm proper. But let me point this out in the meantime. The statements surrounding, you know, here, build the temple, and make sure you know the law of the Lord. The reason those two things are attached to each other is because the symbol and the thing being symbolized ought to be tied together directly. And our problem is that we often replace, this is just humanity, I mean, all of us, we have a tendency to replace the thing that's being symbolized, which is obviously the more important thing, we have a tendency to replace the thing being symbolized with the symbol. Or with the token of it, or with the instrument that brings it about. We think that it's that that's important instead of the thing that comes out of it. So, for instance, I see this happen with musicians. Now, I say this, I'm chuckling because I could never get to the point where I could do this on either side. I can't make real music, and I don't have any great technical proficiency with any musical instrument, including my voice. So I couldn't do this, but I do see musicians who do this. It's one of the things I love about musicians who are actually artistic, because they don't do this. They understand the main point, and that is this. We will replace sometimes music itself, actually making music, right? Not just chords, not just sounds, but music. We all know it when we encounter beautiful music. We run into real music. We can sometimes, and I don't mean we, like me personally, but I know good musicians who can do this sometimes, they will replace great music with a great demonstration of the skill with which they can perform. Now, all of us do this in different ways at times, but I'm picking on musicians only because it's such an elevated gift for a person to be able to make music. You know, I mean, I don't have any encounters in this world that drive me towards the beauty of genuine transcendence, like music. I did it this morning. I was walking my dog, listening on my AirPods. Yeah, I do that sometimes, to music. It was a beautiful song that was provoking all of these dark thoughts, ideas, in a beautiful format, existential kind of ideas about how death brings peace kind of stuff. But then at the end, actually appealed to the resurrection. And I was so caught off guard by the direct appeal in this beautiful song to the resurrection. And it wasn't just the message of it, it was the way it was being delivered in this song that I was driven to tears. And so I'm trying to act like I'm not crying. I'm walking down the street. I'm normal. I'm okay. It was just a beautiful message in music and beautiful music combined. So just a wonderful experience. We know what that is. And it was immediately followed by this performance of musicians who are incredibly talented and were making music. So I'm not saying they weren't making music. And maybe it's just me. Maybe it's just I wasn't in the mood for that. I don't know. But it was more of a showing off technical prowess than it was of actually performing music. Now, you can't make great music if you don't have some skill with musical instruments of some kind, including your voice. Now, I mean, that's just the case. But it is the case that you can bury beautiful music beneath a technical performance. And I've heard a lot of people do that. We do that all the time. Well, that's what's happening. That's what happens a lot in Israel's history. So, I mean, it happens in everybody. For instance, we will replace God, and I mean replace in our minds God himself with religion or religiosity. Now, all of us know that that happens, so I don't have to go into the details to explain why that can show up or how it can be. But I will say it in this case, it's easy to replace the reality of an encounter with God that he wants us to have with all the ritualistic symbols that could be leading us to God, that were designed to lead us to God, that can lead us to God. But sometimes we just stop right there as if we want to stare at the wall instead of walking into the house. We can replace God with the religion or ideas that go with the religion. In the same way, it's easy for us to replace love, and I mean actual love, actually caring about this other person and their mind, their wishes, actually longing for that person and wanting what they want. Love. We can replace sometimes love with the verbiage of love, with signs or symbols that represent love, but aren't really love. Love ya. Okay, that sounds good. But I mean, is there any real love going on there? Okay, maybe. Maybe it's just a token of familiarity that accompanies love. But it is easy to replace the act of caring about a person to the extent that they actually are more important to you than yourself, that you'd rather not be than be without them. Love. You can replace that with these little tokens that in the beginning represented your love, in the beginning were evidence that you loved, but now may have just become substitutes for the love itself. And that's what happens in Israel when over decades and centuries and ultimately a little more than a millennium or around a millennium, they get used to representing, they see, you know, God's holiness is what matters. God's holiness is in the midst of his people. He's demonstrating that in his temple. And so they come to the temple and they remember God's holiness and the barriers that exist so that there is a holy place into which they are not allowed to come and a holiest place into which only one is able to go once a year and so on. All of that representation of holiness, it's obviously just symbol. I mean, it's incredibly powerful and important symbol, but it is just symbol for the thing being symbolized, which is God's holiness itself, right? So we have a tendency to replace the thing being symbolized with the symbols. Israel did the same thing. It was easy to replace the holiness of God with the temple ritual. And to think that you have satisfied this demonstration and encounter with God's holiness because you showed up with a dove at the temple, because you brought a cow, because you washed your hands in the basin. And you think to yourself, okay, now I'm clean. Now I've experienced God's holiness, but the holiness was replaced with ritual. And it's important here that the holiness I'm describing right now, we think of abstractly. We don't give specific content to it. We will. By the time we get to the end of Psalm 72, I realize how long I'm giving to introduce this. I'll just tell you now, this is going to take two episodes to get through Psalm 72. But the point is, this is a really important point. The holiness of God is not empty. It has a specific form. When God says, be holy, because I am holy, he then tells them what to do so that their lives demonstrate his being in this world. And it's not empty. And doing those things somehow becomes this embodiment of God's presence on the earth in a way that we're supposed to remember. And part of creating an environment that welcomed that presence of God's holiness in this world, instantiated in the lives of people, was the presence of this temple. A temple being built by a man whom God said would be able to maintain his holiness in this world because he would know his law and he would obey his law. What would that look like? That's what Psalm 72 invites for us. So as we read the words of Solomon, you know, at the very beginning in the superscript to Psalm 72, that's what we ought to have in the back of our minds to prepare us to understand what David's prayer is going to be about as he offers it. And as he offers it clearly, I mean, he, as the Messiah, is offering this prayer for his offspring, for his son. For if we were saying this more broadly, we would say Yahweh is uttering this desire for his son Israel. He's uttering this desire for his people to live this in the world. And so in the way that David fulfills this, not because David is perfect, but because he is the anointed one of God, we want to be able to live this out as well. And so this prayer for Solomon is very much a prayer for us as well, and one that we want to see fulfilled in our lives. So here we begin in the first section. So there are three sections to the psalm. It's only 20 verses long. And again, the very end of the psalm is just the statement, now David can go to rest. You know, he can hand this over to his son to see him build the temple and keep the law and fulfill the presence of God's holiness in this world. So starting in the first section, first seven verses. By the way, each of these sections sort of breaks itself into two pieces. And the two pieces have a prayer of desire for, you know, what ought to happen with Solomon. The first two are about him specifically, and the last one is one about a blessing for him, right? So a certain kind of blessing for him that leads to a conclusion about Yahweh himself. That's what we're trying to get to, is the conclusion, which is about Yahweh himself. But on our way there, what we're going to find is three sections that are divided into two parts each, where there are several verses, four, in which the prayer is about this, about Solomon's rule itself, followed by a statement about how the world ought to respond to that, what ought to come out of it. And the first section is not about the whole world, but just about the earth in which Israel lives, the land on which Israel lives. And so what should be the case for the people of God themselves? So in the first seven verses, give the king your justice, O God. Give your justice and your righteousness to the royal son. That's verse one. Give the king your justice, O God, and your righteousness to the royal son. May he judge your people with righteousness and your poor with justice. May he judge all of your people in righteousness. And this is an emphatic statement. This is not an additional statement. And your poor with justice. Let the mountains bear prosperity for the people and the hills in righteousness. May he defend the cause of the poor of the people, give deliverance to the children of the needy, and crush the oppressor. That's what it would mean for this to be a kind of nation where the mountains are bearing prosperity for the people and the hills are bearing prosperity in righteousness. That's the point, that the prosperity wouldn't matter if it wasn't accompanied by righteousness, and that with righteousness, the prosperity can be abundant. And so these statements, may he judge your people with righteousness, that's only realized if he's giving judgment to your poor with justice. That is, if he's overseeing those who are in greatest need. That's why it ends with, may he defend the cause of the poor of the people. May he give deliverance to the children of the needy. And may he crush those who are oppressing the poor and the needy. I'll read more to you about that in just a moment, say where that's coming from. But then he goes on to give what would come out of this. May they, the people of God then, may they fear you while the sun endures. So the prayer is for Solomon, but the result of it is what the people of God themselves will experience. May they fear you while the sun endures, and as long as the moon endures throughout all generations. May he, Solomon, be like the rain that falls on the mown grass. It's just everywhere. You can't go anywhere else. And it's blessing and beauty, and it's providing the abundance that's going to grow the grass so that there's even more prosperity, right? So it's a spring rain. May he be like the rain that falls on the mown grass. Now the grass is going to experience the good of it, like showers that water the earth. In his days, may the righteous flourish. It's not just may he flourish now, but may the nation flourish. May the people who are being governed by him. He's oppressing the oppressors, but he is defending the needy. And so the whole ground is being blessed as a result of it and coming up in this harvest of abundance and prosperity. So in his days, may the righteous flourish and may peace. Now his name is Peace, Shlomo, Solomon, right? So it's the same as the end of the word Jerusalem or Shalom you're used to. That's Solomon's name. So this is a prayer for him, but it's a prayer for the people because of him. In his days, may the righteous flourish and peace abound till the moon doesn't even shine anymore. Now, let me be clear on how important that last phrase is. I mean, it's just an idiom, obviously, and if it weren't an everyday idiom, it's certainly a poetic utterance that gives a clear message. Forever. You know, we want it to endure forever. So why do you use the moon to represent that? Because the moon creates all the cycles for us. We're aware of how long a week is because that's how long it takes for the moon to go from being new to being half. So when we look at the moon, we think of it as half. It's the first quarter moon, right? That's the first quarter. So it's, you know, 7 days. And it's to the day. You know, you watch the moon increase every day, and now it's a half moon. And then you watch it for another 7 days, another. So we have weeks because we have a moon. We have months, which are moons. I mean, that's the point of the word. We have months because of the moon. We follow those months to figure out and analyze how long the year is going to go. Obviously, the sun comes around, the seasons come around. And then we figure out how to reconcile it. We have the weird, you know, January and March and May and, you know, whatever, 31 days and then 30 days. And February, you only got 28, except for once every 4 years. Got 29, except for once every four years when it only has 28 again, blah, blah, blah. So that we can make it land just right so we can keep the months, coordinated perfectly with the years, because days and weeks and months and years are governed by the inevitable cycle that the moon follows as it sails overhead and looks down on us with its glowing light. That is the clock of the heavens. That's the moon. It's that steady. And so in this prayer, he's saying, in his days, in Solomon's days, may the righteous flourish and peace abound until time stops, until the moon is no more. That's the, you know, the pendulum of the grandfather clock that you have, that you think of. The moon is the Earth's grandfather clock. It is the pendulum that constantly swings and never stops. And you can just count on it every day. And he says, may Solomon's righteousness flourish until there is no time left. It is an eternal prayer. Okay, so David offers this beautiful prayer for his son, but it's entirely about his people. Now, listen to, in David's explanations of this in the historical account in 1 Chronicles 22 and 28, the prayer was just, obey the law of the Lord. But look what the law of the Lord looks like when Solomon is actually obeying it in a way that makes David say, and now the righteous will flourish until there is no more time. What is it that the king does? It's exactly what he was told to do in Deuteronomy 17 when we were told what kind of king they ought to have. And by the way, the whole first section of that, what kind of king should you have, is the kind that's not serving himself, that's not trying to get a lot of horses and a lot of wives, and not that those two are the same thing. I'm saying that's what the passage says, and not out just conquering for his own benefit. He's not serving himself. He's supposed to be serving the people. Solomon fails in so many ways in that regard. But in this regard, he is doing what he's supposed to do in this prayer. So in Deuteronomy 17, it goes on beyond the, well, he shouldn't be self-serving, gathering a bunch of wives and getting a bunch of horses, to say this. And when he sits on the throne of the kingdom, he will write for himself. This is exactly what David was praying for him, was saying to him in 1 Chronicles 22, know the law, keep the law generically. So that part's here. He shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law. This is how Moses describes a righteous king. He will write for himself in a book a copy of this law, approved by the Levitical priests, and it shall be with him, and he shall read in it all the days of his life so that he can learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes and by doing them, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers and that he may not turn aside from the commandment either to the right hand or to the left so that he can continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel. So what is that? He's writing down the law so that he can read the details of it and do exactly what it says so that the righteousness of God can be revealed through the reign of this king. What is that righteous ruler like? I just want to give it to you in the New Testament first. We could go to the Old Testament. We could look at all of the passages, including in the law of the Old Testament, on how we're supposed to treat people and how we're supposed to regard them. And the central passage in the Old Testament, according to Jesus, Leviticus 19, we could go to all those passages like we have in the past to cover it. But I mean, the perfect expression of it is this so important New Testament passage in Luke that I refer to all of the time. I hope I refer to it all of the time because it's that central. It just begs to be noted that when Jesus wants to give an illustration about somebody who is not righteous, he chooses a judge, one who makes judgments in a certain way. And when David says, what kind of king do we need? We need one who judges your people with righteousness, who judges the poor with justice, so that when the poor come to him, he puts down the oppressors. He responds in a way that takes up the cause of the needy. So what's the illustration Jesus gives in Luke 18? He gives the illustration of an unjust judge, a judge who isn't righteous. What does it mean that he's not righteous? The whole point of the story is the only thing that tells us what it means for this judge not to be righteous. Remember the story? A widow who has been oppressed. So she has no resources. She has no one to take up her cause. She is the model of the needy. And she's had something taken from her by someone, some oppressor over her. She comes to this unjust, this unrighteous judge to seek help. And how is he described? She came to a judge who, it says in the passage, neither feared God nor regarded man. That's how he's described. He doesn't care what God's law is. And he doesn't care about other people. All he cares about is himself. He doesn't regard other human beings. Well, they can't do anything to me, so why would I care about them? He has no regard for people. And he doesn't care about this poor widow's need. And when Jesus draws the conclusion to the parable, which you know the story, I'm not going to get into the story right now. I'm not trying to teach the parable. I'm just trying to make the point that when Jesus wants an illustration about what would be unrighteous, what would be in complete opposition to God's holiness being present in the world, when he wants to create the starkest contrast he can with the holiness of God, the contrast is finding a leader who doesn't care about the poor or the needy who are under his care. And so Jesus actually says the words at the end of the story. So listen to what the unjust, the unrighteous judge says. The point isn't about the unjust judge. The point is about the story of the unjust judge. Listen to what the story of this unjust judge says. And then he gives the contrast, the a fortiori argument that we've talked about before, I'm not going to go through again, to make the point that if this unjust judge is willing to give in to the pressures of a poor person who comes to him so often that he's not willing to resist it anymore, obviously God, who is holy, who is righteous, is going to respond to the prayers of the oppressed who are under him. God's righteousness is that he does care for those who are being oppressed. Our unrighteousness is that we don't care for the oppressed, who ought to be taken up, whose cause ought to be taken up by us. That's the central feature of what Jesus says in the Gospel of Luke about what it would be to reveal the holiness of God in this world. So I'll only use that for today to make the point. I'm not going to go to all the Old Testament passages that make the same point. And I am ignoring so far one of the most important features of the psalm, because it's not as emphatic in this section as it is in the next, which is weird. I mean weird. I haven't even told you what the feature is yet, so you don't know why it's so weird. But I mean, this stands out as a prominent feature in the psalm. And I love it when psalms work this way, or any passage, when you're working through it and you recognize a real anomaly, I mean a genuine anomaly. And then you realize later that anomaly has become not an anomaly, but a feature of the passage. It's the point of the passage. And that's what happens with this one. Here's at least a foray into what this is about. When you read in verse 1, give the king your justice, O God. Give your righteousness to the royal son. May he judge your people with righteousness. And then you get to the next verse, and it says, let the mountains bear prosperity for the people. There is a built-in connection. And I've spoken about this before in previous episodes and back when I was on the radio. We talked about this kind of stuff. But it's prominent in this psalm. But only momentarily here. I mean, he hits on it, and then he like a butterfly, just lights on it for a moment, and then he's gone. Verse 3, let the mountains bear prosperity for the people. The mountains and the king are being analogized here. So the king is bearing righteousness for the people. Therefore, the mountains are bearing prosperity for the people. And in that parallel, you expect this psalm to become that kind of a metaphor, that kind of analogy, where he's saying, well, of course, as righteous as the king will be, that's how righteous the people will be. And as righteous as the king is, that's how prosperous the land will be, and that's how blessed the people will be, because that parallel connection between the king and his people and the land and the whole environment is so woven into not just ancient literature, and not just more recent, like medieval literature, but into the human psyche. It's built into us. We're so individualistic, and I'm not even saying that critically. Again, I love liberties and love individualism in our society, but we're so individualistic, we've sort of suppressed our awareness of how we identify with this truth. And we do, in our own hearts and souls, we do psychologically identify with this reality, that our hero represents us, and not just in some abstract way. Our welfare depends on their welfare. Again, in this part of the psalm, which is about the people of God, it's about Israel themselves. In this part of the psalm, he touches it, and then he moves immediately off of it. You know what the next part of the psalm is? This part ends with Solomon, with David's prayer that under Solomon's reign, the people will fear God and they will follow Solomon and be blessed in him, and Solomon will bless them like a rain coming down on the plants of the field and so on. It all ends with Israel being blessed, right? The next part of the psalm isn't about Israel at all. It's about the nations, the Gentiles. And it's there in the prayer for the nations that this imagery of the king blessing all of the people really bears fruit. And that's weird in an Old Testament passage, you would think. But it is the point. And it's such a clear and obvious point in this psalm. I can't wait until we get to talk about it in more detail. So here's where we are so far. We have David praying for Solomon to be blessed because he wants the people of Israel to be blessed. We have the anticipation of the next section of the psalm, starting in verse 8, where he's going to pray again for the reign of Solomon. Oh, and it's a powerful prayer. It's the kind of prayer you have about Jesus coming in judgment, right? So Solomon's going to bring judgment to those wicked people in the earth. And yet it's not negative at all. And you'll see why it's not negative at all. There's no, it's not even a challenge to get there. It's a beautiful passage, but it's a beautiful passage of blessing for people you wouldn't expect David to be focused on blessing in some way, but he does. But it doesn't end with David just praying for something regarding Solomon. But by the end of the psalm in verses 15 through 19, it's about David praying something about Yahweh himself, something so that we can understand why seeing God's holiness, why living in this world and not seeing God's holiness is so vapid, but why it's so important, not just to us, but to God, that we see his holiness. Why his holiness is so important, not just for us to see, but then for it to be realized in us. Why does his holiness have to be so importantly demonstrated in us? What does that bring as a result that makes this so important? More on that when we return to Psalm 72.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.